Good morning, everybody. The paper we're going to look at is the IFRIC update from July 2015. And there were three items I wanted to highlight for you from this particular, update. The first one is the first item on page two of the update. And this is an issue that the Interpretations Committee has been looking at for a few meetings now. It came to us as a question about one particular type of transaction, one of obtaining joint control in a joint operation when previously having just an interest in the joint operation but without that joint control, and the question being whether event of obtaining joint control should lead to a remeasurement of the pre-existing interest. Now, the Interpretations Committee wants us to look more broadly at this because they were aware that there could be a number of different transactions in which you are gaining or perhaps losing, whether it's control or joint control or significant influence, etc. And so what we did for the July meeting was to prepare a matrix of these different transactions, looking at where we've got some specific guidance already on remeasurements and where we don't, and also doing some outreach as well about which of those types of transactions are common and which ones aren't. And so in looking at that, the Interpretations Committee narrowed the scope of this down onto the three types of transaction that are listed in ABC on this particular write-up, which was about obtaining joint control of a joint operation, losing control resulting in having joint control in a joint operation, and also looking at the change of interests resulting in a party to a joint operation obtaining joint control in a joint operation. And they've also asked us to look at both when there is a business present and when there isn't a business present, and to come back to them with further analysis on what we think should be the sort of the driving factor as to, or the determining factor for whether you should remeasure or not that either pre-existing interest or the retained interest when you're dropping down. And that's something that we then continued on two weeks ago with the September meeting, and we'll be bringing you a paper to a future board meeting that will set out some proposals for clarification in the standard on some of these transactions, and also look at asking for your guidance on one in particular that potentially has an interaction with the equity accounting project as well. Perhaps just worth mentioning that the focus here has been on joint operations, and one of the reasons for that is that joint operations will sometimes be in an entity, sometimes they won't be in an entity, and so that raises particular questions in people's minds about what the accounting is. That's why perhaps this is perhaps a little less straightforward than when there is just a regular entity present, and we're talking about a joint venture where we would do equity accounting. The second item I wanted to talk about was the next item on page two, which was to do with the deliberation of comments that we'd received on the narrow scope amendment for amendments to IFRS 2. This was an exposure draft that had been published in November last year, and had proposed three narrow scope amendments to IFRS 2. We received 70 comment letters, and the Interpretations Committee has taken a look, an analysis of those comments received. Now, I think it'd be fair to say that sort of in general, the response were mostly supportive of what we were intending to do, but there were, as we would normally expect, a number of suggestions as to how we could improve the amendments that were being proposed. Now, we'll be bringing you a detailed paper with that those recommendations from the Interpretations Committee to a future meeting. But one that I wanted to just highlight here was to do with the narrow scope amendment on classification of share-based payment transactions with net settlement features. So these are ones which They are settled partly in shares, partly in cash, with the cash being paid to the tax authority to settle the employee's income tax obligations in respect of the share-based payment. This is an area where there is a distinct difference between IFRS and US GAAP in this area, because US GAAP has a specific exception that permits the whole of the share-based payment to be accounted for as if it is equity settled in its entirety, notwithstanding the cash settled portion of it. And we're certainly aware that there has been some significant diversity in practice under IFRS on this issue, hence we had proposed in the ED an amendment that would change IFRS to introduce an equivalent exception in IFRS 2. Now, one of the items that came out of the Interpretation Committee's discussions here was the recommendation that we add an additional disclosure here to this particular amendment, because the effect of this amendment is that we would have equity settled accounting through to the settlement of the obligation, and then at that point when the cash is paid over to the tax authority, it would be then that you would recognise the additional amount that is being paid in settlement of the cash paid to the tax authority, which could be quite a bit higher than the equity settled value. Equity settled value, of course, will be based on the grant date fair value, whereas if we had been doing cash settled, then we'd be revaluing to the current fair value of the share as we go along. And so when we get to this true-up event, when the cash is paid, we need to deal with that. And the committee has recommended that we add in an additional disclosure there during the vesting period to just alert readers of the financial statements to the fact that there is going to be this additional payment coming through, which otherwise wouldn't be disclosed or recorded in the financial statements. Sue.
Thanks for that. I just wanted to comment on that, because when we proposed this narrow scope exception in the narrow scope amendment to say that you could treat a scheme where the employer had an obligation to pay a cash amount to the tax authorities in the context of a scheme that was otherwise equity settled, it sounded relatively discreet and innocent. But what struck me in the papers that came back to the Interpretation Committee and the analysis of the comments that we got back is that the number of circumstances in which the amount that you initially sort of tag as being equity, even though it's going to be paid in cash, is subject to all of these true-up adjustments. And so this concern that you've mentioned, that I might have initially flagged 15 of equity as being my obligation, but actually it turns out to be 30 of cash. And because we've taken away the true-up, suddenly the thing that looks like 15 of equity turns into 30 of cash. And the users at the table express concerns and reservations about how useful the information was. So I think it's good that they suggested a disclosure requirement, but for me it's sort of, everybody, when you read the papers, please look carefully at whether or not it's really a good thing to have this equity label attached to these schemes, because I think the consequences, certainly for me, were much more severe than what I'd thought about when I was voting on the original proposal. Yeah, and even in some cases, you can end up paying cash to the employee, because if the amount of shares you set aside turns out to be more than what you should have been, what you needed to use to settle with the authority, you can actually end up paying cash to your employee, which I think was something that we hadn't really thought about in the amendment.
That's right, we hadn't thought about that, and that came out through the comment letters, and so we've got a worked example for you that we'll bring in the paper that just sort of shows how the numbers work, both in terms of the simple cash payment to the tax authority, but also, as Sue says, if more shares were withheld than were actually used to settle the tax obligation, and that balance was paid in cash, our proposals as to how you would account for that additional cash element.
I'll say on that one, based on the ED we proposed, if that could happen and did happen, that would have precluded, the ED we proposed would have precluded classification as equity settled for such a scheme if they can end up paying cash beyond, because it was limited to the withholding amount. And that sounds like it's an amount.
The problem is they estimate the withholding amount, and if they estimated 20 and it ended up being 15, the 5 of cash can go back to the employee.
If that's the problem, that the 5 of cash goes to the employee as opposed to them getting the shares and not.
Yes, yes.
So I think technically speaking, they might, at least it was arguable it was in the scope, but anyway, we'll see it in the paper.
Yeah. Okay. And then the final item that I wanted to just highlight was on page 4, and that was a proposal for annual improvement relating to IAS 23 and borrowing costs. Again, we'll bring a paper to you to a future meeting, but just to sort of give you some advance notice of this. This is a situation where a company has borrowed funds specifically for the construction of a building. They complete the construction of the building. So during the construction period, also they capitalize the borrowing costs into the cost of the building in accordance with IAS 23. When they cease construction of the building, they then stop the capitalization of borrowing costs into that building. If, however, the company still has other assets that it's constructing and this particular loan remains outstanding, then the question is, should the future borrowing costs that are incurred on this outstanding loan be added into the general pool of borrowing costs for capitalization into other assets, or should it be excluded completely and not taken into account? The Interpretations Committee here agreed that there was lack of clarity here in the standard, and their recommendation is that specific borrowing should then form part of the general borrowings after the completion of the construction of the original asset. But again, we'll bring you recommendations for that to a future meeting. Where go? Sorry, I missed your card earlier.
I have a general comment on the 11 joint arrangements. You know, we just had a discussion about whether we should change revenue standards for some reasons. And even with the condition, FSB proposed some kind of changes. And the general consensus among board members is we should make it stay as stable as possible for new standards. The 11 is a new standard, you know, published several years ago, you know, start to implement, you know. And then we continuously change. I can see the reason, that is, 11 focus on the judgment, whether you should classify as joint venture or joint operation. You know, when we developed that standards, we did not pay attention to the recognition and the measurement, particularly the changes, you know. Now, the standards are already published and start to be implemented, and we change continuously. Really, you know, personally, I worry very much, and my constituency from China worry even more. It's because China still follow the convergence approach. You know, they recently integrate our requirements into the standards, and before the finalized convergence standard, they already asked me, Weiko, is there anything, you know, on the lines you intend to change? I try to give them as much as possible, and they finalize already. And we now start more changes. And my question to you is, you know, on the one hand, we got so many requests. On the other hand, whether the members of interpretations have a similar concern as me or as other constituencies?
I can't speak on behalf of the Interpretations Committee in response to your specific question. I think I would observe, though, that what we've been looking at here is specifically where we can see gaps in the literature. So rather than sort of changing what is currently there, I think I would characterize these as really the objective anyway, is to see, well, are there specific types of transaction where we currently don't have specific guidance, and can we help people by filling in those gaps? I agree with you that, you know, to change the requirements can be unsettling, and we should be very cautious about doing that sort of thing. And I think when you mentioned sort of number of changes to IFRS 11. When I look back to what we've done with IFRS 11, we had some initial changes initially to do with principally, I think, the transition requirements, which I think was good to sort of clarify those or to give some extra relief. And then last year, we had a number of agenda decisions relating to IFRS 11, which were aimed at clarifying the existing requirements. So I think I would try and draw a distinction between where we're trying to clarify or fill in gaps in the literature versus where there are where we're changing the requirements. But I take your concern.
Yeah. I just had a point about this share-based payment discussion that we just had. I'll look at the example, but it strikes me as odd as if you're going to create an exception in a situation where a company is overwithheld because it's an estimate, an amount, and then has to return some cash, that all of a sudden changes the character of the transaction and overrides the exception, and that portion has to be treated as a cash-based plan or liability. It doesn't seem to make sense with the concept of an exception, because all you're doing here is truing up the amount of cash that you originally collected. It was wrong in the first place, now you're returning it. So now you're going to split this and bifurcate it into two different types of plans. I just think that's overly complex.
I don't know that wasn't what I meant.
I'm not saying that's what you meant. I'm just saying that if that's the outcome here, it seems somewhat odd.
Yeah.
Am I understanding this correctly? Or
my question is whether it's a good exception in the first place when I start thinking about those sorts of things.
Okay, well, that's a different question altogether. But
I would say, Pat, the current requirements, as I read them,
right,
for us to, are to require bifurcation. So that the portion that is equity settled is accounted for as equity settled, and the portion that is cash settled is accounted for as cash settled.
Agreed.
And there are complexities in terms of applying that. Because if you're not sure how much is going to be settled in cash,
right,
particularly if you've got graduated tax rates for employees, then, of course, which tax bracket an employee falls into may not be known until
very
end. And so there can be uncertainty.
It's usually not over withholding is not the problem. It's usually under withholding, because I was a participant in these plans in various occasions. Usually the rate they use is 25%. You know, and if you make more than $100,000, you're already in the 28% bracket. Okay, so it's not a difficult number to hurdle. But if they overwithheld, it just seems to me that we're being over pedantic about that difference. I can understand clearly if it's a cash-based plan versus an equity-based plan, but this is a service that essentially, you know, the Fidelity, the Schwabs of the world are providing for the administrator, the plan sponsor of the stock option plan. And they're saying, instead of them having to go into the market, sell, get the cash, and then go out and, you know, buy the stock, we're going to essentially accomplish that transaction and collapse it. And by the way, you also owe the U.S. government, you know, or your state, a certain amount of tax. It just seems to me if they overshot that to characterize certain piece as now a cash-based plan, to my mind, it doesn't make sense. But I'll look at it.
Yeah.
Right.